KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. In this coming year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm very excited to have on Professor Natasha Dow Schull of MIT, author of the book Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. This is a book which, quite frankly, I should have had Natasha on a few years ago, simply because this is a topic that I've always been very interested in, and for reasons that I can only blame, and I'll do this because I'm a radio host, I'm going to blame Google and their search engine for not identifying me, but the reality is I missed it. Natasha has been a scholar over several years focusing on a fascinating and challenging question of the entry and use of technology in Las Vegas and in the world of gambling. Anyone who plays cards, we can start there, as you know, and move from there to machines, knows that oftentimes the reason why people are playing cards is not because of strategy necessarily. It's not because of the social aspects of it. It's because they want to win. And in Addiction by Design, Natasha, through a variety very intense empirical research, talking to people in the industry, talking to gamblers, talking to people who are sadly afflicted with gambling addiction, learned a tremendous amount of information about how the industry itself builds its machines around the goal, as the title suggests, of getting people not just to play, but to play a lot. And at that level, there's certainly a disturbing message in this book about the nature of industry and technology that we might explore a bit. But specifically, and the title suggests it, Natasha is focusing on how addiction is created through the use of these technologies. The book is one that goes not just in the direction of technology, but also focuses a fair amount on how the psychology world defines addiction. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but as the focus of Hearsay Culture really is on technology, and particularly and more specifically, we've had lots of discussions with technologists about how technology is coded and designed to perform certain functions, this is a particularly useful topic. I came across Natasha's work, as I mentioned, not through a Google search, but rather through an interview that she did recently with Evan Selinger, who was a previous guest on the show, who probed some of these issues. Evan's interview is wonderful, and I commend it to anyone that listens to the show that wants to look at another angle on this work. But we're going to take this deeper dive, given the format of the show, into these myriad issues. The last point I'll make by way of introduction, which I think is one that is worth noting up front, is that a lot of what also we can think about here are these procedural issues involving things like the relationship between the gambling industry and regulators and the gambling industry and consumers, and even between the different gambling entities themselves that we're going to talk about a bit. It overlaps a lot with the regulatory issues that we've talked about in Hearsay Culture over the last several years involving how decision-making occurs within the broad range of technology policy, from government to the private sector. And here, too, in the conclusion that Natasha wrote, and that ultimately I think we can update a little bit based upon even newer technology that have come out since this book was published in 2012, she writes about the relationships and as she uses the word, the collusion between the gambling industry and regulators that seems to appear. So we'll spend some time on that as well. By way of very brief background, and I'm going to ask Natasha to talk more about her background in a moment, she's a professor in the program in Science, Technology, and Society at MIT. She is joining us on July 7th, 2015 via Skype from upstate New York. And Natasha, I thank you very much for joining us today on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
So let me start off with a question, as I alluded to, that I ask all of my guests pretty much. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you wrote this book.
Well, the story behind the book goes way back. It's no overestimation to say that I've worked on this for about 20 years. So I was 19 years old, headed out to UC Berkeley for my first semester of college. I was a very provincial downtown New Yorker, and the plane was routed through Las Vegas. I got off the plane and I was a little overwhelmed by the people I saw walking around. But more than that, the machines that I saw greeting people as we walked off the plane into the waiting area. I just remember walking around and looking at people's faces as they were playing these machines. Then I got back on the plane, went to college, pretty quickly decided I was going to be an anthropology major, and ended up writing a senior honors thesis on Las Vegas, because that was an era of anthropology when the sights were being turned on ourselves, so to speak. It was no longer the move necessarily to go to an exotic far-off land, but what is happening right around us on our own soil that perhaps is exotic or perhaps is so normal that we don't consider it exotic but deserves an anthropological gaze. So in that spirit, I went and lived in Las Vegas for about 3 months when I was around 20, and wrote my senior honors thesis on the architecture and design boom that was going on in the 1990s. That's the era of Disneyification of Las Vegas. And it wasn't explicitly on gambling. In fact, I really bracketed the question of the kinds of behaviors that were unfolding in casino spaces. I was more interested at that time at looking at how these casino operations, these mammoth, carefully managed systems were being designed, and how designers were making choices about where to put carpets and the accounting systems. However, that the senior honors thesis did end on the slot machine. The whole chapter was about the slot machines, because what I learned was that where you place a mirror, how you twist a carpet, how you design your accounting systems, all of it has to do with getting people to slot machines and keeping them there, because they have really become the money makers. So as a graduate student, you know, I went far and wide in search of a topic for my dissertation, also in anthropology, and kept being drawn back to Las Vegas. And ultimately, I decided I'm just gonna return, but this time I'm gonna take the brackets off the question of gambling and try to look at these things together: the architecture and the technology, and then the experience. So that's really what I try to do in my book: is try to understand how one's intimate experience gambling at the machines can be shaped by not only architecture and algorithms and the kinds of seats, et cetera. So really toggling back and forth between those.
And I'll tell you, it's, you know, as you were saying this, I think it bears noting, you know, you are focusing on the machines themselves, as opposed to, and I couldn't help but think of this as I read your book and thought about the show, but it kept coming back into my mind, and I'm sure it's something you're familiar with, the scenes in Ocean's 13, which I assume you've seen, but if you haven't, the scenes involving the Greco player tracker, I think is what they called it, but it was a machine that basically was designed to surveil gamblers to determine whether they were cheating on the games. I guess I could ask you whether this kind of technology exists. I think at some level it does, but I want to be clear for the listeners. You are focusing, which I think is maybe not self-evident unless you actually saw the cover of the book or read it, you're focusing on how the machines themselves are designed and as we'll talk about, can be reprogrammed for an individual player. And with that in mind, and the reason I ask that question this way is, you know, you frame the book around addiction. Perhaps you could give us not a clinical definition, but when you're talking about addiction, you're focusing on addiction to gambling. How do you define addiction in the context of these machines and what, as we'll talk about, Las Vegas is doing?
So just to start off, I think addiction is a relationship, and any good addiction researcher, whether they're looking at marijuana or the internet or opioids, understands that addiction is a relationship. And we always hear, you know, things like alcoholics don't come in bottles, they come in people. the same thing gets said about slot machines by the gambling industry, obviously. And there's always these efforts to place the source of addiction on one side or the other of the human object kind of equation. You know, is it in the person? Is it in the substance? Is it in the activity? But as I said, any good addiction researcher understands that addiction can't possibly be located that way. It's something that unfolds in the interaction between a person and a substance, an activity, and in this case, a very complicated, multi-layered machine experience. So this is really my working definition of addiction, which I think that others share. I should say that most of the research on gambling addiction that has been funded in this country focuses on individual gamblers as being the source of the problem or the interesting piece to look at, the interesting side of the equation to look at. So you've got a lot of studies on neurochemistry, even, you know, biographical background, behavior, cognitive behavioral kind of research, et cetera. And very little takes into account the whole other side of the relationship, which is the machine. So I absolutely think that some people are more vulnerable to addiction. But I also think, by the same token, some substances, objects, etc., are more likely to addict, and the slot machine, for various reasons, happens to be one of those. So, you know, we always hear talk about problem gambling and problem gamblers. I like to say I see this also as a story of problem machines.
You know, and I think we can talk about it probably later in the show. You know, as you think about these addictions, particularly driven by technology, of course, there's been a lot of writing over the last few years about addiction to iPhones, right, or addiction to Facebook. And some of those chemical reactions, even, that I think that you write about in the book with regard to gambling addiction, seem to also play a role in why people can't stay off Facebook. And we have these horrific stories from time to time of parents whose children got injured, or even worse, while they were on computers. And of course, there's a variety of reasons why these things happen. But it does seem like we have a broader trend of addiction through technology, perhaps, that we can dive into. But before we do that, and I want to drill down on the focus of addiction to gambling, an early thread in the book, and one that you come back to, is this concept that you learned from interviewing gamblers called the zone. What is the zone?
So I kept hearing this term over and over again as I sat in on Gamblers Anonymous meetings, which was one of the early sites of my research. I actually started going to those meetings when I was writing about the architecture, and it just sort of was something interesting at the edges, and I then went back there. And so many people I had expected to find, like, the little old guys with the hats, you know, and their little notebooks going to the racetrack or sports betting. But really, 95% of the people back when I began this project that would go to Gamblers Anonymous were playing machines exclusively. And I realized after talking to them that to really understand what was going on, I had to understand the technology. But one of the things they kept talking about was the machine zone. And that was a question that I asked all the gamblers across the board. You know, when I would hear them say it, I'd say, what is the zone? And they would sometimes struggle to put words to the zone. They would draw on metaphors of magnets, or being in a tunnel, having tunnel vision, being hypnotized was a big one. You know, the zone was a kind of stand-in for a kind of experience where the feedback loop that they are caught in at the machine is so tight and quick and interactive that it completely concentrates their attention and really blots out the world, blots out their lives emotionally, financially, even their bodies. A sense of their physical bodies would fade away. And this was interesting to me because we think of gambling as being about risk and thrill and fun and excitement, but really what they described gambling for was the zone. That's what they were after. They weren't after winning even. They were after this zone of escape where everything else fell away. It's kind of trance-like state, I guess I'd say. And in that trance-like state, the aim is not to win. The aim is to keep playing. And once you're really caught in the zone, once you're really a gambling addict, you don't, if you do win, if you do happen to win a jackpot, you don't get up and go. You stay there longer. It's, one gambler told me, it's like further ammunition for the zone. And this point got really driven home when I kept hearing in my interviews, people would say, you know, it's so weird, but when I win a jackpot, I get kind of irritated and angry and frustrated. And the reason they said that is because when they won, the machine would sort of freeze up and play a little victory song, and it would make loud noise so that people would be looking over at them. And suddenly the whole reason they were there, which was to stay in a state of kind of flow in this machine zone, had been interrupted, and they were almost rudely deposited back in the world by winning a jackpot. And it really frustrated them. And that was a real turning point in my research.
So when we see, and you know, I'm making reference to these popular images because I think for many people they're the influence. So you know, the assumption I think that someone that wasn't familiar with this would assume is as I said in the introduction, right? They're there to win. So you know, is it really a function at this point in terms of the kinds of addiction that you're focusing on that when we talk about the zone, it is literally nothing more than how long can I play a game, which is how people wind up losing their homes. Is that a fair summation of what the zone is, or are there contours there that are missing?
Well, the way you phrased it, how long can I play the game, still had an element of challenge or contest. Okay. Or actual sort of gamification to it, like there is a goal. But actually, it's not about accomplishing or, you know, let's see how long I can sit here. It isn't about that. It's about really losing yourself, losing a sense of self. And that's actually quite opposite to how anthropologists have defined and others have defined gambling, or even writers have defined it as a real search for the self. The famous sociologist Irving Goffman described it as card gambling, as a kind of character contest where you were there to really demonstrate courage and resilience under, you know, contingency and stress. This is really, you could say, the opposite. It's opposite also to Clifford Geertz's famous description in his work on Balinese cockfighting. He describes gambling as being about deep play, and by that he meant a lot was at stake. Your whole sense of self, your social identity was at stake. This form of gambling that I found in Las Vegas and delved into is really about a retreat from the existential stakes of, you know, being a self. It's about numbness, self-forgetting, forgetting where your hand ends and the machine begins. It's really about absorption. It's a state of escape and absorption. And that really goes against this idea of challenge or contest or risk or all these things we associate with gambling.
And so we're chatting with Professor Natasha Schull of MIT, author of the book Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So I think it's important to emphasize this, Natasha, before we talk about the machines themselves. You're talking about machines, and the machines, incidentally, could be machines that are portraying cards. So it could be a poker machine, or it could be, as we will talk about it, these line games, which we can talk about too, which are baffling in terms of how you figure out whether you're going to win, but you're hitting buttons, as you point out. So it's a matter of just being in that zone. But to draw that, to make that distinction clear, when, you know, if you think about the colloquial addicted gambler who is playing because they want to win money, because they're going to pay the rent, and then they're going to go further and they're going to become rich, and in the process bankrupt themselves. That's not quite the addiction that you're focused on. Am I right about that?
You are right, and it's not to say that it doesn't start out being about that. In the book, I distinguish between the hook and the hold. And the hook is often a kind of enticement to someone who hasn't yet played the machine. Like, ooh, you can win, and the sounds, and you're sort of drawn over, and you might have a sense of thrill and a dream that you'll win big. But if you sit there and gamble long enough, and often that happens because you do win in the beginning. Very often gambling addicts have stories of a big win in the beginning. And if you have a big win in the beginning, you're going to be motivated to keep at it to get another. And in the process of keeping at it, you learn through interacting with the machine that it gives you this other reward, if you even want to call it a reward, which is the reward for the reward of just escape and absorption. And people kind of discover that, and that ends up being what holds them there. So I like to distinguish, it's not that the other isn't there at all at any point, but that the zone and this search for escape and absorption for gambling addicts comes to override the search for a win. And this is a real stumbling block, I think, in the public's idea of gambling addiction. Legislators, people just don't understand, they don't identify with it. It seems so odd to them. Why would somebody sit? They must be wanting to win. They must think that they can actually win the rent this way. Like, what's wrong with those people? Did they miss the day on probability in high school math 101? And that's really not the case. A lot of these gambling addicts who would sit there for whole weekend long binges had professions such as they were accountants. There was actually an awful lot of accountants, people who really knew how to manipulate numbers and financial stakes. They knew rationally that they couldn't win. They also knew that if they did win, they'd just put it back in the machine. They understood themselves remarkably well, but that didn't mean that they were able to stop themselves, just as you find with alcoholics. And really, that's what this is. I mean, you asked earlier on, you know, what do you mean by addiction? And I gave a somewhat complicated roundabout answer, but I could have just said, you know, addiction is when you can't stop. And you know, these machines, for reasons that we can sort of distill, there's many, many reasons why these machines make it difficult to stop. Mm-hmm. But if you want to really boil it down, it's because it formats an interaction, this human-machine interaction, that's rapid, solitary. There's no people sort of interrupting you, like in a poker game where you got to wait for the cards to come around. You have to sit there. No, it's totally rapid, solitary, and it's continuous. And those three elements add up to a really potent kind of interaction where you can get into that absorption.
It is a remarkable ability that we have to, and I'll use this particularly hyperbolic word, prey on each other through devices, which is why you started alluding to it. But given the focus of the show, I do want to ask you more detail. You know, so if we're talking about getting gamblers into this zone, which mutates them perhaps from even, as you point out, wanting to make money to just, and I won't even use the word play, being engaged with the machine. What are, in general terms, the technological capabilities of the modern gambling device? Meaning, what in 2015 are designers of machines able to do through code to achieve that addiction? And then after the break that we'll have shortly, we'll get into some of the user interfaces and tracking and the like. But what are the broad capabilities in these machines themselves?
Okay, let me first say that if gamblers talk about the zone, the industry analog for that would be a phrase, time on device. And they use that term so often, they shorthand it as TOD. So they don't sit around saying, how can we get gamblers in the zone, mm-hmm. and how can we get them addicted? You know, their goal is not, on the face of it, to addict people. Their goal is to maximize the bottom line, and what they've learned from looking at their spreadsheets and their revenue over time is that the more time on device that you give people, the more revenue you're going to get. So if, as I said, if gamblers talk about the zone, the industry talks about time on device. And if you go to these global gaming expo trade shows or read in the trade magazines, there's all manner of techniques by which they try to give gamblers more time on device. You just asked me, you know, how do they do that through code? In fact, some of the first ways and ways that are still very important don't involve code at all. There are things like having, instead of levers to pull, buttons to press. So that was a big early advance that really sped things up, but it made it more continuous and harder to stop, because if you have a bill acceptor, this is another thing, the accepting of money. If you've got buttons to press instead of reaching up and pulling a lever, it's much more effortless to keep going. If you've got a bill acceptor where you can slide in $20 instead of putting coins in one at a time, again, it's much easier to just keep going. You don't have to pause and make a decision with each insertion of each coin, right? So it's like removing the opportunities for self-stopping and compressing the greatest number of spending gestures, you could say, into the smallest unit of time. So those are two big early, and by early I mean in the 80s and the 90s, ways that were found to increase this time on device and increase revenue on slot machines. Nowadays, you're still pressing tiny buttons, sometimes a touch screen. You're really just moving a finger. You will still sometimes see levers on slot machines, but they call them legacy levers. And they're really just there because they're iconic. And any machine that's got an actual handle that you can pull on with your arm in that classic gesture also has buttons. So if you're going to play it for a while, you quickly realize it's easier to just press the button. And these days, instead of bill acceptors, typically you're playing off gambler player cards. Sometimes they call them reward cards, loyalty cards. You get the idea. You've got credit stored on it, and you're playing off of credit. So money has been further dematerialized than even the bill acceptor. You're just putting your card in there and kind of forgetting about it. You're playing off credits. What are some others that are not code? Another big one is ergonomic seating. Hmm. So there's whole chair companies that design seats especially to allow you to sit for longer and not become fatigued. There's special attention given not to cutting off blood flow for the elderly, etc. And you'll see things on their websites like ergonomic design increases time on device. You know, everything is in the service of keeping people there longer, drawing them in further. And you'll see so-called sensory ergonomics. Both, you'll see it visually, so you've got the sort of soft pixelation of the monitors, and we used to have all this crazy blinking signs all over and lights above the machines. There's been a real turn away from that because they've realized that you want to keep people's eyes focused on the screen in front of them, not raise it up and away and, you know, overstimulate. And it's the same with sound. There used to be a philosophy that, you know, buzz, bing, bam, the louder, the better, a sense of winning. But now, as time on device is really the thing they're trying to supply rather than a sense of winning, there's more of a turn towards sort of softening and balancing acoustic elements. One company plays all the sounds on its machines in this thought to be universally pleasant key of C. So you've got all these kinds of things, and maybe after the break we can get into some of the more mathematical code elements.
Absolutely. We're chatting with Professor Natasha Schull of MIT, author of the book Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to listen to KZSU and to make a donation. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU, and I encourage you to click on it as many times as possible while you're in that zone and donate as much as possible. I don't know if what I think what I did there, Natasha, was a pretty crude way to attempt to get people to donate more money, not nearly as sophisticated as what you write about in the book. Let's dive right back in, and I love that you encouraged me to ask this question, Natasha, because I will. Let's talk a bit about user interface. I'll tell you, when I started the book, I figured, okay, all right, the user interface is going to be, you know, a way to get people to play the game and to give them a sense, and here's my ignorance, give them a sense that the odds are a little bit better, perhaps, than they think in their favor. And I play cards, and I go to casinos. I generally, personally, play your traditional old-style card games that are quite different in terms of what you're describing. But I think about a game like three-card poker, where you can make a bet to get the highest possible hand in three-card poker and get a 40-to-1 payout. I've seen that happen. It's not impossible to happen, but it doesn't happen that frequently. But certainly, when you look at it, you think, "Oh, that's a great payout, and the odds probably maybe or something I could live with." Definitely, the casino has the benefit on it, but I'll give it a shot. I would be wrong, right? Based upon what you know, your study and the research that you did, and what we talked about here, in fact, you have this difference that I want to ask you about between what you call the virtual real and the actual real, which I think is fascinating. So, why don't you tell us a bit about these line games and also about what this distinction is between the virtual real and the actual real in these machines and how it ties into addiction?
Okay, those elements have to be parsed please. A little bit.
Yes.
So, the traditional machine that we all recognize, that iconic three-reel bandit, or one-arm bandit, right, with three reels, you're trying to line up symbols on one line across three discrete physical reels that are spinning more or less independently of each other. So you pull the handle, you try to line up symbols across one line. This was in the pre-electronic days. You really had to limit in order to make a profit on that machine. You couldn't offer large jackpots because that just wouldn't mathematically turn in your favor in the end. It was limited by the number of stops on each reel, typically 22. And so when electronics came along and computerization, that's when this crafty virtual reel came into the picture, which really changed the whole equation and was one of the big reasons that gambling was able to become popular. So the virtual reel sits inside the machine, and it's on a little chip. This is the computerized aspect, and the virtual reel isn't limited to just 22 different positions that it could stop on. The virtual reel can have 500, right? And there's three of them. They each have 500, and anytime you pull the lever, press the button, you're triggering the random number generator. And the random number generator can be completely random, but just like pulling out of a hat can be completely random. The way that you constrain the odds is by the mix that you put into the hat on the little pieces of paper, or in this case, the mix of stops that you're putting onto the virtual reel. The virtual reel is hidden, so people aren't seeing this giant thing spin in front of them that has mostly blanks, but that's what's happening inside the machine. And then after the random number generator has been triggered, it's generated results, then this thing happens called virtual reel mapping. That's when this result from the random number generator, instead of mapping it to the positions on the 22 stop physical reel that you're seeing spinning in front of you, you're first mapping it to the virtual reel. And most spots, surprise, surprise, on that virtual reel are non-winning. Mm-hmm. And then those are mapped over back over to the physical reel that you see in front of you. And surprise, surprise again, the algorithm is that most of the time it's going to fall right above or below a winning symbol or on a blank. So what you've done there is, through computerization, all of a sudden, people who are sitting in front of this machine interacting with it, it's no longer like interacting with a pair of dice where you get a real intuitive feel through time of what your odds are. Just as you get an intuitive feel playing a slot machine of what the odds are because you see the drums, the three drums in front of you with the stops, there's all of a sudden a divorce between what you intuitively feel the odds to be and what the actual odds are inside the machine.
And so based upon your definition of addiction and the zone, the contract lawyer in me, the tort lawyer in me, thought initially, this is fraud, right? In other words, the gambler is being misled. But I'm not sure that that's entirely the case. So what do you make of this? And I'm not, I know you're not an attorney. I'm not asking a legal definition. But what do you make of this in terms of its ability to mislead, given what gamblers who are using these machines, at least those that are addicted, are thinking?
So in the 1980s, there was actually the company who had done this the best and was doing the most sort of interesting things with it, especially loading most of the outcomes to fall above or below a winning symbol, for example, so to create a sense of near miss on top of losing, was a Japanese company. And so the American companies got together. They didn't like this at all. And they actually brought a legal case against this Japanese company. And there's really interesting testimony where you have all of the major U.S. gaming corporation, most of them still around, companies like Bally, International Gaming Technology, or IGT, et cetera, standing there testifying using the exact words you just used. This is misleading. This is, an illusion, creating an illusion. This goes against consumer protection laws about misleading graphics. This is, lying to the consumer. And then, of course, they all say, but if it gets legalized, we're going to do it too, because it's a really great business proposition. But I also should say that this technology we're talking about has basically become, for all intents and purposes, obsolete. Because what you've seen now is a retreat away from machines that have any kind of physical reels at all to machines that are purely video. And when you've got purely video machines, the virtual reel and what you see in front of you sort of it's collapsed again. And also the need for near misses is that's also moot now, because you've got so many symbols packed into these screens. You're no longer lining up one set of symbols across a line. You are doing zigzags, horizontal, multiple vertical lines. You're lining up a whole lot of stuff on each spin. Sometimes you don't even know what you're lining up. Sometimes it's a so-called scatter play, where you have no idea what the rationale is behind a winning. It just blinks at you in this, from this scattershot kind of position. So you've seen a move away from the need for physical reels. So that whole question of actual versus virtual and what might be misleading about that has sort of been left behind. I agree with you that it would have made a great a legal case, and a couple of people tried to bring that legal case. They just argued it badly because no one was explaining the math and the computerization properly. Mm-hmm. But now we're in a different world with a different kind of machine doing different kinds of sketchy things, which I'm happy to go into.
Yes, please. You know, I wanted to come to tracking and capture in the last 5 or so minutes, but please, yeah, because you had said in a book that downloadable gaming and some of the changes were beginning to occur when the book was published. Obviously, we're a few years later, so please go on.
All right. Well, I think I'd be sad for this interview to end without listeners knowing about what is the most popular, most addictive kind of game today, mm-hmm. and what does it do that's most ethically problematic?
Yes.
So I was just talking about these three reel games where you're lining up symbols on three drums across. That's a really volatile game, because if you think about it, you're putting in a coin, and if you line the symbols up, you will double or triple your win. And if you don't line them up, you lose it all. That's a sort of definition of volatility. These newer games that I was just describing show a kind of grid. It's a video screen which is a grid of many symbols. There can be as many as 50 lines across that you can win on. There's multiple reels, typically 5, but it could go up to 10 sort of rows of symbols across. And what you're doing there, it's almost like you're diversifying your portfolio. It's a low volatility game, and I'll explain why. Because gamblers are putting 50 coins in, and guess what? They're probably going to win on some of the lines. It's like compressing 50 hands of play into one because of the video and computerization capabilities. So you put 35 in, you win back 20. You put 50 in, you win back 40. Almost every hand, you're getting some kind of audiovisual feedback of winning. So if you have a real win, meaning you actually get more than you put in, you hear ding, 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 ding. And if you have a net loss, put in 50 coins, you win back 20, you hear ding, 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 ding. So that every single hand gives you the same feedback. Now, that's a perfect formula for getting into the zone. It's not about the fact that you're winning more. It's about the fact that you're sitting there relaxing into this steady, dependable rhythm. It's not about risk. It's about dependability of feedback. And this mechanism has been called the false win. It's a way of sort of nibbling slowly at your budget down to zero, giving you more time on device. And it's a sort of steady, small wins that are actually losses. So I think there's a legal case to be made here that some tech-savvy legal group should jump on.
And what would be the broad contours of the case in your mind?
Well, you're giving people the feedback of winning, and in fact, you've got evidence from brain research on these slot machines showing that the human brain interprets these losses mm-hmm. as being wins. It's as simple as misleading graphics,
yep.
right? I mean, you're saying, yay, you won, ding, 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 ding. But in fact, you didn't win at all. You lost. It's the way things are being framed. You're being misled graphically through audio, visuals, et cetera. And you're being given more time on device along the way. This has sometimes been called Costco gambling, and it's a formula for profit making that's profit from volume, not price. Because you have to understand, each line you're betting on can be as small as a penny per line. So it seems really light. It seems right. really harmless. Oh, the penny machines. But in fact, over time, people are sitting at these longer, losing more than ever.
So, yeah, no, it falls, you know, it falls under on a spectrum of misleading behavior, and I think there potentially could be a challenge there. We're chatting with Professor Natasha Schull, author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. We are at, Natasha, what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking you questions that you may not have time to answer adequately, which is particularly difficult for my guests who almost uniformly answer questions well. And so this is a challenge, but I'm going to keep going.
I'll be quick.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's the challenge here. So we'll see what happens. So let me do one follow up on what you just pointed out before we turn briefly to tracking and capture. So you know, it seems to me that if we're thinking about legal cases as well, you know, the downloadable gaming aspect, which I wanted you to talk about briefly, I think is very interesting. The notion that, as you write about in the book, that machines had physical components inside the machines that made it more difficult or laborious for casinos to change the game from one game to another because they had to physically go in and change boards and the like, changes when you have code in there. And you simply download a different program the way you might on your iPhone with an application. To me, and this is my question for you, that's a rampant, there's rampant possibilities for abuse there because the games change. And therefore, potentially, the odds are changing. And, you know, as we talk about representations, the question becomes how clear it is to the player that the game has changed or the odds have changed. Describe downloadable gaming a little bit for us and then how that ties in not only to addiction but to these risks of abuse that we've been talking about today.
So with downloadable gambling, there suddenly will be in the back room that mysterious dial that gamblers have always thought was there, which hasn't actually been there, which is the dial that managers can turn to sort of crank the odds up and down depending on how someone's playing, or, you know, give them a win right when they need it to keep them there, etc. That capability has existed for a while. Now it's coming on the scene because of downloadable gambling. Within 20 seconds, you can download a different game to the machine. But it's not quite as sneaky and sinister as that, because we've still got laws about what you can and cannot do. So for someone, you know, the manager can certainly download a game in 20 seconds, but in between one game and the other, the machine has to sit quiet, silent, and rest for 2 minutes. Then there needs to appear a sign saying that something's changing. Once the new game is on that machine, another 2 minutes need to go by. So it continues to be impossible legally, I should say it continues to be unlawful, to crank that dial in the middle of someone's, in the course of someone's play, after they have commenced play, and change the odds up on them. I do think, though, I do agree with you that it is going to become increasingly hard for the consumer to know exactly what the odds are and what they're playing, because they'll be at a terminal that, you know, can be changed, or that they themselves can change by going in and picking a different game to download for themselves. So with downloadable gambling, you're not only seeing increasing control on the part of casino managers, you're seeing increasing control being given to the player, sort of inviting the player in to sort of construct their own Skinner box, as it were. You know, what kind of risk volatility index would you like? What kind of denomination are you, do you like lots of steady wins over a long period of time at really small, tiny wins? Or do you like dry spells because you're going for the big jackpot? So you can really individualize and customize once you bring the gambler in. Or once you draw on player tracking historical data and say, huh, Fred just sat down, and we know about Fred. We know what he likes to play, what he reacts to. He just put his player card in. We say, hi, Fred, and we offer him a set of games that we know that he likes that are profitable for us when he plays them. So you're going to see all kinds of, you know, this, a lot of the same things we see with sort of taste preference kind of Amazon.com, these big sellers who can detect your preferences from past purchases, and, you know, maybe you'd like to buy this book. So that whole conversation from the internet you see now transferred over to the gambling world.
So let me ask you a couple more questions here in our waning minutes, Natasha, because there's a lot to talk about. I think I'm going to pass for the moment on tracking, because I think in light of that answer and what I think are really challenging issues, I want to raise them here. You know, on Hearsay Culture, we've talked about a lot of different technologies. And, of course, it strikes me that this kind of technology and the ability to set up devices this way, of course, could be useful outside the gaming industry and the gambling industry, but into other interactions with consumers. I mentioned at the beginning of the show the ability of Facebook to addict people. To be clear, I'm using conjecture there. Having studied this industry, do we have current examples of gambling industry technology or methods moving into other areas like other consumer markets?
Well, it's more like a constant cross-pollination back and forth. And to be honest, there's been more that's come into the gambling industry from other places, such as, you know, player tracking cards. The origin there is frequent flyer cards in the 1980s. Then the gambling industry sort of took that and ran and made a much more robust, intensive kind of tracking. They're tracking sort of live laboratory data where they know how many clicks and whether you speed up in your clicking in relation to certain game elements. It's not this really simplistic data of how many times you travel to Chicago in a year. So you've seen over and over again that the gambling industry will take things and techniques from other places and then elaborate them and adapt them. You don't see so explicitly people in other industries taking things out of the gambling industry. But recently, you have seen a convergence of the so-called social gaming, like I'm thinking of Zynga and Candy Crush and all this manner of games, and the gambling industry. It's quite a literal convergence in that each of the large gambling machinery equipment manufacturers has bought out or been bought out by an equivalent social gaming company. So you've seen mergers between, you know, Zynga and WMS and IGT and some other. And what I think this portends is an increasing kind of blurring of the lines between what we're playing on our little mobile devices on the way to work on the subway in the morning and what we might play when we go into a casino. And one of the specific, perhaps troubling techniques you see already on social games that isn't quite yet allowed in gambling is something called dynamic game balancing. And this would be sensing how you're playing in the middle of a game and then dynamically balancing the game to adapt to what you might want, maybe giving you a little win because that would keep you there. And wow. People, although this is technically not allowed in the casino industry, there are people out there right now coming up with patents that, in crafty ways, get around that.
You know, as someone, like I said, who plays cards, and who has played enough cards to know what I enjoy about playing cards and not. That sounds wholly unappealing to me, not just from an odds perspective, but it doesn't sound fun. Now, it's fun for iPad, as your title suggests. It may be fun for those that are there for different reasons. It causes me to kind of throw this out there, but not really ask as a question, because I want to ask you lastly in about a minute or so about regulation around this. But it strikes me that if that's where industry heads, they're going to be probably excluding some people anyway from the worlds that they want them to enter in. But of course, they will assume that there are more people they're going to go the route of saying, I don't know what's going on, but I'm excited by what I'm seeing. Let me ask you this question, Natasha, like I said, very quickly in the wildly unfair portion of the show. As I mentioned in the introduction, industry capture concerns come up, the regulators and the regulated having a cozy relationship. Very quickly, describe that relationship, and I guess I should ask it by way of closing. Do you think that this current state of our regulations and regulators have the ability and the willingness to guard against these kinds of abuses that would turn these games into nothing more at all than manipulation across the board?
So what you see now, just as you saw in the 90s, which was another wave of the expansion of gambling technology, is a recent recession and states scrambling to increase or refill their budget coffers with gambling money instead of raising taxes. So you see it in Massachusetts, you see it in the state of New York, countless other states. This is not about Las Vegas anymore. It hasn't been for a while. It's about Costco gambling, time on device profit model in your backyard. And with that, you know, there's been a sort of reluctance to stop carefully and think about what the kinds of technologies that are being invited into the backyard. And what I see as the real problem is that we don't, you know, I don't want to praise the FDA, but at least we have a governing you know, unit that is supposed to oversee pharmaceuticals. We don't have that for a lot of this new technology. The gambling industry likes to say it's the most heavily regulated there is, but in fact, what's being regulated is absurdly small. You know, oh, the random number generators function. Great, they function properly, but no one's regulating the algorithms that they're choosing on, that they're choosing their random decisions on. Nobody's regulating the audiovisual feedback. Nobody is studying what's going on at these machines. Some kind of consumer protection, tech-savvy consumer protection is needed both in this domain and the domain, I think, of so-called social games. So that's really what I would like to see more conversation about.
Professor Natasha Schull, I mean, that's a call to arms as far as I'm concerned, Natasha. So I definitely invite you back, perhaps to have that more regulatory discussion. But in the interim, Professor Natasha Schull of MIT, author of the book Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, fascinating book, and one, quite frankly, that's disturbing. You know, we're so short on time, but I feel like I have to ask you this question. This is totally normative. After having done all this research, do you like the gaming industry? I mean, how do you feel about it personally?
Oh, I've never liked the gaming industry. But if you were to ask me, do I like casinos or gambling, I might give a different answer. My husband loves coming along with me when I do my research because he's a live poker player. And I'm not a policewoman at heart, so I would never want to shut down the basement poker games. I like a good time. Gambling's great. It's more the sort of the technological manipulation, the hoodwinking, the secrecy, the non-transparency. That's what I recoil against.
Yeah. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. Fascinating work, and I look forward to inviting you back on the show in the future.
I'd be glad to be back. Thanks, Dave.
My pleasure. We have a couple of shows left on this somewhat truncated summer schedule for Hearsay Culture. Coming up at the end of the quarter, Professor Margot Kaminsky of Ohio State University College of Law on trade and surveillance, and Lorelei Kelly on legislative decision making. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen Fridays, 3 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous nearly 240 shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by reaching me at dave@hearsayculture.com, or by going to the contact link at Hearsay Culture. So, thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.